Hello, my name is Dr. Kara King.
Hi, I'm Dr. Mary Rensel, and we are your hosts for Inspirations and Insights from Cleveland Clinic Women Docs.
In this podcast, we will share conversations with women doctors from all career stages and practices, exploring the highlights and challenges of being a woman in medicine.
We hope these thought-provoking stories inspire you and provide insight into the unique challenges and accomplishments of remarkable women docs.
Hi, everyone. My name is Hadley Wood. I'm vice chair of the Department of Urology, and I'm really, really excited to be here today filling in for Kara King and Mary Rensel, who are your regular hosts of this podcast, Inspirations and Insights. They're off enjoying their summer, and so I jumped on the chance to take advantage of getting to interview one of my most favorite people at the Cleveland Clinic. Allison Vidamos is professor and chair in the Department of Dermatology here at the Cleveland Clinic, and she has been in that role for now 18 years, almost the entire period of time that I've been an employee here at the Cleveland Clinic. And over that time, I've just become a huge fangirl watching her be a leader and a master clinician, and also someone who's contributed to the culture and the life of the faculty here at the Cleveland Clinic, in particular, the WPSA. So I'm very excited to introduce Allison today. She's professor of dermatology and chair, as mentioned, since 2005. She's also in the section for micrographic surgery, or also known as Mohs surgery and cutaneous oncology here. And she's program director of that program's fellowship. She's also a member of the board of directors of the American Board of Dermatology and the Ohio Dermatologic Association. And she's an expert consultant to the United States Pharmacopoeia Compounding Committee and has contributed to that effort. We'll hear a little bit about that later. She's also been the lead author of numerous journal articles and book chapters, and she's authored two textbooks. So without further ado, I really would like to introduce Allison to you today, who is coming to us today because she's recently announced that she's going to step down from her role as department chair. And so today we'll be talking to her about her next chapter and reflect back a little bit on her career in the Department of Dermatology. So without further ado, welcome, Allison.
Thank you very much, Hadley, for that very kind introduction.
Well, it's just, as I said, I'm a huge fangirl. And when I was asked to sort of step in and help out with some of these podcasts, I was very resistant at first, but I wouldn't pass on an opportunity to have a conversation with you about your long career and your thoughts about your time here at the Cleveland Clinic. My first question to you is, you know, you've had a very long career journey here, starting out first as a pharmacist and then making the shift into medicine. Tell me how that journey impacted the doctor you became, and I guess more importantly, the sort of person you became, the parent, the neighbor, the friend.
Thank you very much. I started pharmacy school at Purdue University. And it was after I had to back out of going into veterinary medicine because I am very allergic to cats and dogs, but my goal was to be a large animal vet. But when I realized that was not practical to get through the schooling, I changed into pharmacy school, which I very, very much enjoyed. And about halfway through pharmacy school, we had rotations in the hospital where we rounded with the physicians. And it became very apparent to me that I really liked what they were doing, how they were interacting with patients and helping them with their medical issues. I was counseling them on medication interactions and changing doses because of liver or kidney insufficiency. But what I really realized is that I want to do what they're doing. And so about halfway through, I looked into the prerequisites for medical school and made the decision that I would finish my pharmacy degree, take my boards, become a pharmacist, and be able to work as a pharmacist to help fund medical school, which is what I did. At the time, I was also on the varsity golf team at Purdue, and I enjoyed that very much as well. But I quickly realized with my plans to go to medical school that something had to give because that was a huge time investment. So I stepped off of the golf team after a couple of years and really concentrated on my studies to get into medical school. And I successfully got into Indiana University Medical School and started at the Indianapolis campus. And the nice thing about having the pharmacy job was I, again, had a couple jobs while I was in med school, but I also had the opportunity to give pharmacy law lectures to my medical school class, which was really fun and interesting. Back then, we wrote prescriptions. Now we type them. So a lot of my teaching was on how to write a legible prescription. but it was a tremendous bridge for me. And one of the funniest stories was I was working weekend shifts from 9 p.m. to 7 a.m. on Saturday and Sunday while I was in med school. And I was in the pharmacy in my third year during my pulmonary rotation, and my staff in the pulmonary rotation called down to ask a question. And when I answered his question, he said, "Man, your voice sounds familiar. Who are you?" I said, "I'm Allison Vitamus." And he said, "Wait, aren't you my medical student? What are you doing in pharmacy?" So it was just a really great way to interface with my staff and obviously help fund my medical school tuition and expenses and such. So it was a really good bridge for me. And I kept my pharmacy license for 25 years. And have used it in other ways, specifically with the United States Pharmacopeia, being an expert consultant to them as a dermatologist. We've done some great work in that arena. Specifically, we are working on getting a drug monograph for in-office buffered lidocaine. So we buffer our lidocaine before we do biopsies and procedures so it's less uncomfortable for the patient. And the pharmacy can either make up that solution for us, or we can make it in the office, and we can very safely make it in the office. And we just completed a lot of testing to prove that. And we're now submitting all that data to the USP so they can help us write a monograph that will allow us to continue doing this for our convenience and our patients' comfort.
Wow. I just can't imagine like how much jockeying there must have been to be on your study group for pharmacology course in medical school. So I think we share my mentor in the Department of Urology here was one of your medical school classmates. And he always said that you were like the star medical student in the class.
So he was.
So I just have to ask, actually, before we move on, what happened to your golf career?
So when I was house staff president, would hold golf tournaments for all of the residents and staff. And we had some guests come in. My brothers came in and played, and we had tournaments and prizes and fundraising and such. I have not played in a while. My hope is that when I do take up the clubs again, that I will forget all my bad habits. But when my husband and I were dating, we did play a lot of golf. And my whole family plays golf. My brothers are scratch golfers. My parents were both very good golfers. When I was dating my now husband, my dad said, "So what, tell me about this guy." And I said, "Oh, he's a dentist. He's from Michigan." And he said, "Well, does he play golf?" And I said, "Yes." And he said, "Can you beat him?" And I said, "Yeah, are you a little too competitive?" "Yes, I can beat him." But
that's awesome.
Yes.
So have you ever had a hole in one?
I have not. But Pretty much all my family members have, so I need to get on it.
You definitely do. It sounds like goal number one after retirement.
Yes.
Gosh, I have so many questions for you. I guess I want to start sort of just with a reflective question about your career here. You know, your history with this organization has been really long. And what I've been so amazed by as I've sort of watched you from afar for these decades is that, you know, you've always been a leader who, number one, has been clinically just absolutely respected for your skills and for your clinical acumen. Number two, as a leader, you have just always remained beloved. And I know that through sort of all the hard times of these past 18 years, that it has been almost impossible to have your faculty still sort of love you, even when you're making hard decisions. And number three, you always look like you're having so much fun doing it. And that's like, that's right. That's the sort of secret sauce. So I guess my question is, you know, what skills have you had to nurture to sort of have the kind of staying power you've had over these almost two decades as a leader?
Thank you very much for those kind comments again. I would say that I have learned to be patient, resilient with tough situations. I've always tried to lead by example. So when there are major changes in our staffing, in our clinics, I say to the staff, "I know this is hard. I agree this is hard, but I'm doing it too." And I think that lessens the blow with a lot of the changes that have come down the pike. I try to lead with humility. I try to lead with humor. And your observation of me looking like I have a good time is legit, because I do try to bring joy and humor every day to my practice, to my administrative work, because I think it helps people weather changes better if you do have a lighthearted look at things and just say, you know, this isn't the end of the world. These are changes that we're making for these reasons. And again, being transparent, I think that we build consensus and make significant good change going forward. I try to be a good mentor. I'm an advanced peer coach. I enjoy that work as well. And I will say it has been a gift at the clinic to have so many learning opportunities with, you know, the leading in medicine, leading in healthcare courses, a lot of the GLLI courses that we have. There are so many resources for people in leadership positions, those seeking leadership positions, to make them better leaders. And I have taken advantage of those opportunities and, again, encourage others to do the same.
I love that you're an advanced peer coach. I think probably a lot of people listening to this podcast have taken advantage of that. Can you share an example of an experience you had within your role, either as a mentor or a coach or as a mentee, that really sort of made you have insight into your own career or life?
I would say, looking at some of my younger staff, I see myself at that stage of life. You know, they're having kids and having to juggle work and their home life and such. And I feel like I can totally empathize with that, even though that part of my life is behind me. Now I'm a grandmother, so it's coming back. But I feel I can relate to them and their issues. And one of my mantras is family comes first. So if a staff member or a resident or a fellow comes to me with a family issue, I say, you know what? Family comes first. Yes, you need to go do that. You need to get on that plane. We will cover your practice. We will cover your patients, because in the end, family does come first. And we have work family and we have home family. And you need to kind of learn to work between the two to keep the staff happy and fulfilled and successful.
Yeah, that's so true. I mean, I think it's sometimes easy to forget when you get so wound up and like, oh, I got to get this done, or I have to meet this metric or whatever, that everybody has something going on after they walk out of the office. And I suspect that that's probably one of the main values that you've brought to your leadership that's allowed you to have so much efficacy as a leader, and also, you know, have such positive connections with your faculty and trainees.
One of the things I encourage my new staff and trainees to do is to watch the Cleveland Clinic empathy video from several years ago.
Yeah.
Oh my goodness. I've watched it several times and I cry every time, but it really makes you think when you step on an elevator and you see somebody with kind of a sad face, something's going on with them, and brighten their day. Just do a little thing, because you have no idea what a difference you can make with just a simple gesture, a hello, how's your day going? So just to put yourself in other people's shoes, whether they're patients or colleagues.
Yeah, that's so true. Actually, that elevator moment has stuck with me all these years too. I don't know what it was. It's like that one scene in the elevator. You're just like, oh yeah, I do that. How many times a day, you know, where you're looking across at someone and you have no idea what they're bringing with them that day, for sure. So as you look back on your career now, are there like any times that you feel could have sort of tilted in a different direction and maybe dramatically changed, you know, sort of like the elevator doors moment? Like, I forgot that movie that with Gwyneth Paltrow, but like maybe could have changed things entirely for you had they gone a different direction.
You know, a couple of years ago when I did the keynote address for the WPSA meeting, I presented what I called a series of fortunate events instead of unfortunate events like the movie.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I remember that.
There were specific things in my life that could have gone in a totally different direction. The first of which was when I applied to the dermatology residency. Back then, it was all typed out. There were no computers. And there were only two early match positions or programs that matched you right out of medical school for dermatology. One was Minnesota, one was at the Cleveland Clinic. And I did receive an interview at Minnesota, but I never heard from Cleveland Clinic. So I called them and said, hey, did you get my application? You know, I just need to know my status. And they said, no, we never got it. So I retyped the application, climbed in my car on a snowy December day in a snowstorm. My mom came with me, and I physically drove my application from Indianapolis to Cleveland. and walked into the T building and handed it to the education secretary. Otherwise, I wouldn't be sitting here interviewing with you.
That's crazy.
So that was one. When I was a resident, there was a call from Oberlin Clinic to Phil Balin asking for someone to cover a maternity leave for a dermatologist there. And so I did do that for 3 years during her leave and then after. And that fateful event was I met my husband at Oberlin Clinic. So that was a good choice. In 2000, the clinic used to have an exchange program with Singapore, and they sent physicians from the Cleveland Clinic to Singapore for 2 weeks at a time to teach lectures, do surgeries and such. And I took that job, and I didn't want to be gone for all of the 2 weeks. So I compressed the 13 lectures into 8 days and did all the requested surgery teaching. And the day I was leaving, the chairman of the National Skin Center said, hey, we'd like you to stay a couple extra days because as a thank you, we want to take you touring in Malaysia. And I said, thank you very much for that offer, but I really need to get home to my kids. They're 5 and 7. It's Halloween. He didn't know what Halloween was. But I said, it's Halloween. It's very important. I need to get home to my kids. So I went home that day. On Monday, I was at work and my husband called me and he said, you know, that flight they were going to put you on, it crashed.
Oh my gosh, really?
And half the people in the business section where I would have been sitting perished. And I thought, I have a guardian angel. And every Halloween, I say, thank you, God, that decision was the right one.
Wow.
Yeah. So those were very pivotal moments. And then last one, of course, was when Phil Balin was stepping down as chair, I was asked to consider the chairmanship. And at the time I was 46, my kids were 10 and 12. My husband had just finished medical school and residency and fellowship. And we were kind of just getting in our groove. And I just didn't think it was the right time for me. And I didn't think I was up to the job yet. And I've received a lot of encouragement and mentoring from Wilma Bergfeld and Phil Balin and others in my department and outside of the department. And I'm so glad I took that job when they offered it to me in 2005, because it has been a very good 18 years, obviously with challenges all along. But I think as a professional, it's been probably one of the highlights of my career to be able to lead the department for the last 18 years. And I'm very grateful for that opportunity.
I never thought I would hear Allison Vidimus sort of admit to like having imposter syndrome, right? I mean, I guess that's something we all face, and the power of just having someone who you respect and admire come to you and say, like, I think you'd be great for this job really resonates with me, right? Because I think we all need to think about doing that more for our peers and our mentees and even for people that may be above us. And I suspect that you've done that lots of times in your careers, go to people when you know that they don't think they're ready and say, you're ready.
Correct. There's a lot of merit in and positivity in lifting up others who, like I was in that same situation. I just said, I'm not ready for this. I don't think I have the tools. And I took their counseling and mentoring seriously. And I've tried to do the same for others and in my department and outside my department. I'm a mentor for the AAD, the American Academy of Dermatology. And it's amazing how similar the situations are for people in private practice outside of the clinic as they are for folks I've mentored here.
What do you mean by that? Like, put some meat on that.
So for example, I was asked to mentor a young Mohs surgeon from St. Louis, and she was married to a radiologist, as am I. And she said, I'm just all in on my career and I'm never going to have kids. And I said, you know, really think about that, because I had my girls while my husband was in medical school. He was a dentist when we got married. And then a year after we got married, he said, I want to go to medical school. I said, I don't think that was in the prenups, buddy. But he went back to medical school at the age of 32. And we had our girls while he was in med school. I was working full time. And we made it happen. And my girls and my grandkids are the biggest joy of my life. And so I really counseled this woman to think about that. Well, lo and behold, she ended up having a son. And whenever I see her at meetings, she still thanks me. She said, my son Carl is the light of my life, and thank you for leading me down that path.
Yeah, I remember my own comfort. I had not had any children yet, had not started trying to have children, and I was having lunch with one of my attendings who I respected a lot, and I know this is like not legal now, but like he asked me, you know, are you going to think about having a family? And I said to him like, oh, the time is just not right. And I just remember so clearly him looking across the table and saying to me, the time's never going to be right. And I just thought like, oh, that's so true. Like if you wait for like that perfect moment in your life when you're, you know, working and your spouse is working, that's right, it will never happen. And I went off on vacation the following week and found out 6 weeks later, I came home pregnant from that vacation. So I guess I did listen to some of the things my attendants told me as a trainee. So I want to turn the subject a little bit to something that's close to my heart and I know close to your heart, and that's international medical volunteerism. So you've been doing it for years. I can't remember. Do you want to just give me, it's been, how many years have you been involved with your project? And
so I went to Honduras for 11 years. The group I joined had already been going for 11 years. So the whole time was a 22-year span where Russ Raymond, who's a cardiologist at the Cleveland Clinic, led this group of docs and nurses for week-long trips once a year. And halfway through, after their 10th year, the dermatologist who used to go with them could not go. He reached out to me and said, hey, Allison, I'm involved with this faith-based mission trip to Honduras every year. Do you know any dermatologists who would be interested in participating? And I said, how about me? So I went my first year. I could not believe how poor they were and how in need of medical attention these folks were. We, with 8 to 9 docs, would see up to 500 patients a day. And we could do this because there was no Epic. We just had half pages of handwritten notes. And we would write down our diagnosis and the medications that they needed from our pharmacy that we set up ourselves. And then they would be off to the pharmacy to the translator who would tell them how to take their medicines. I had such an amazing experience that first year. I went the next year and I took my oldest daughter. And then the next 3 years, I took my youngest daughter. They were both in high school. And I think it really taught them the importance of volunteering and how lucky we are here in the United States to have the medical care that we have. And it really helped them with perspectives at the high school level to say, there are just things that aren't important that don't matter. Mm-hmm. And I think helped them mature. And then after that, I took residents with me. So I took either a Mohs surgery fellow or one of my medical derm residents, and they also had tremendous experiences. And we basically are doing procedures on school desks and using flashlights. There's no path, there's no cultures, there's no film, there's no x-rays, you know, no radiologic studies, no labs. You basically had to figure out what somebody had just looking at it, which is a tremendous learning experience.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. Can you share like one story from all your trips there that really sort of you feel helped you become a better doctor or a better person here at home?
So one year, one of the ER docs who was on the trip came to me and she said, I have a 5-year-old girl who's got an abscess in her neck and I don't feel comfortable doing this procedure. Would you do it? Because she knew I did derm surgery. And I said, of course. And we, over about an hour, drained this abscess on this little girl's neck and she was crying and then she'd settle down and we just took our time. And I had a translator talking her through it and her mom through it. And at the end, she said to her mom, Mommy, thank the doctor for being so kind to me.
Aww.
And I just melted. And then I prayed for her for that entire year, hoping that she survived it because it was a horrible staph abscess in her neck. And the following year, we went to the same town and I looked for her. I said, I've got to make sure she's still alive. And I looked in all the classrooms and I found her and I knew it was her because I could see my little IND site on her neck. I kind of hid because I thought if she saw me, she might have some PTSD, but I was so grateful that she survived it because it was a pretty bad infection. And, you know, we could guess on the antibiotic because we didn't have cultures. So that experience alone just made my day.
Oh, that's really, that's such a heartwarming story. And it also, I think, sort of gets to, you know, these times that we're called as physicians to sometimes inflict great pain and discomfort or sadness upon our patients. And you sort of wonder, like, is it worth it? Am I putting this patient through more than he or she can tolerate? Are they going to have PTSD for the rest of our lives? You know, and so to see on the other side, oh, you know, the good parts, I think really sort of help bolster up you in those moments where you're just not quite sure if you're doing more benefit than harm.
For sure. You're absolutely right.
Yeah. So what advice do you have for a young person who's just like starting out a career in dermatology or in medicine or surgery?
So as I did, I so benefited from mentors and coaches who really helped me find my way, to find my strengths, to find my balance between work and home life, to help decide what to take on and what to not take on. I also really encourage my residents to look at the service end of what we do. I mean, those patients coming in many times are scared. They don't know what they have. They're afraid they have cancer. And to just really be empathetic, patient. You know, if you've got a patient who shows up late for their visit, see them, be patient with them, because you don't know what they had going on in their day that made them late for the appointment. And be a good listener. I mean, I feel like I have learned so much from my patients. All of my patients are awake when I operate on them. So they know my story. I know theirs. And I'm astonished at what patients remember. I had a lady come in a couple months ago who said, you may not remember this, but I call my Mohs surgery patients at night. And she said, you called me to check on me that night, and I could hear your kids in the background, and your one daughter was kind of fussy. So you let her get on the phone and say hello to me.
I love that story.
Her name was Catherine, and I was astonished that she remembered that. Mm. And lo and behold, while this lady was waiting for her wound to be repaired, my daughter Catherine, who's now 30, called me up. So I walked in with my cell phone, and I put it to the patient's ear, and I said, this is my daughter Catherine now, 28 years later. She wants to say hi again. And it was just really cool.
Yeah. Yeah. It's really amazing. Like when patients sort of, you realize the patients are sort of wondering about your life too, you know, it feels much less unidirectional when a patient sort of engages with what's happening outside the office for you. Yeah.
When I was on the phone with patients, one time when Catherine walked up, she said, mommy, I need you. And I said, honey, just a minute. I'm on the phone with a patient. And she said, can I be a patient?
It
reminded me of that MasterCard commercial with the woman who's on the business call, and her three little girls are around her on a beach, and they said, can I be a client, mommy?
Yeah, that's so true. That's one of the great struggles, I think, of parents who are working doctors, for sure.
Yes.
Yeah. I think a lot, like when I think about sort of young people looking for mentors, and I hear a lot from them, you know, oh, I don't know how to find that mentor, or I'm really anxious about going and asking that person for mentorship. So going back to that, your advice about finding mentors, you know, what would you say is like the secret sauce for finding, you know, the mentors you need in that moment of your career, and any advice about how to go about that?
So when our new residents and fellows come in, one of the number one questions we get from them is, do you have a formal mentorship program? And ours is what I would call informal, meaning we ask them to look for staff who they think they can relate to. They may not be in the specialty area that they eventually want to go into, but we have folks, I mean, we have a very good open door policy in our department. And I think our staff are very approachable. And so we encourage the fellows and residents to find somebody who might give them guidance on career, but others who might give them guidance on home life issues. And so you might have a couple different mentors. So to just look for somebody you can relate to, who you can openly share things with, and who you know will keep your confidentiality and help you find your path.
Yeah, that's so true, right? I feel like the new age, I think, of mentoring, for sure, there's a lot more people that are willing to sort of mentor and coach the way that we sort of learn in the program. But I just remember as a young person going to some people and sort of looking for guidance, and I got a lot of just like, you should do this, and this is what I did. And it's sort of like, oh, yeah. Okay. You know, so it can be hard to find that person who really pulls out from you what is the thing that's going to allow you to find joy in your career and in your life.
And I think the clinic has done a great job with a mentor program, a mentorship program, and a coaching program. So there are people there outside of your department who are willing to do that mentoring and coaching for our staff, for our residents and fellows. And I really encourage my staff to take advantage of those opportunities.
Yeah, I think sometimes, like, I found it really beneficial to me in having mentors that are outside my specialty area, because there are times that I'd be like, oh, well, I can't do this because of X, Y, or Z. And their perspective is so different. They're like, well, that's sort of nuts. Like, we always do it this way. So I feel like sometimes it's really easy in your own like little world and culture and everything of your department or your whatever to sort of get your head stuck in this thing about impossibilities because nobody else has done that. Right. But certainly having someone who's like, you know, for whom whatever that choice is normalized really feels like pretty liberating as a mentee, for sure.
Exactly. Yeah. And the other thing I tell them is do not be afraid to reinvent yourself, because I have been fortunate that my career has gone in different directions for the last 38 years. I used to do a lot of laser surgery and cosmetic work. Now I'm 100% oncology. I used to do 100% of our pediatric laser procedures for kids with port wine stains and other dermatologic issues. And now I've got pediatric dermatologists who do that. But I'm grateful that I had those opportunities and kind of push the envelope in different areas of our specialty. And I tell that to our residents as well. Do not be afraid to change course. In my family, my husband, who used to be a dentist and who's now a neuroradiologist, I used to be a pharmacist and I'm now a dermatologist. We call ourselves retreads, like a tire retread. Mm-hmm. And I tell my girls the same thing. If you want to change course, do it. I mean, you've got to be happy doing what you love. And sometimes that's going to change as goes. My youngest daughter is an engineer. She works for Eli Lilly in Indianapolis. She's toyed with going back to school to be a physical therapist. I mean, I said, honey, it's okay to change course. Mm-hmm. Go where your strengths are. Go where your loves are.
So, I mean, that's like the perfect softball for me, because on the topic of reinventing yourself, you've got a next chapter coming up, post-dermatology chair. So I'd like to know, what's your next chapter? I know that you're not the kind of person who's going to be done setting the world ablaze. What's next for you?
So I'm going to continue my clinical practice. I'm on a smaller FTE. My husband decreased his FTE a couple years ago because of a couple medical issues. And so we're going to match our days. And I love what I do. I feel so blessed to have the profession that I have. I plan to continue to operate probably 4 or 5 more years and teach and mentor. I'm very involved in the American Board of Dermatology, which I, again, really enjoy. It's a 9-year appointment, and I'm in charge of the Mohs surgery board exam, as well as the in-service core exam surgery questions for the residents. And I really, really enjoy that. So I will continue those endeavors. And I'm on the American Academy of Dermatology Board of Directors for a 4-year position. And I'm really going to enjoy that as well, really from an educational standpoint and also for legislative and advocacy issues. So those are other things I'll be continuing on.
What about those days that you're not working, besides going for that hole in one? What other things are you going to be doing to pave the next way for you?
I have got 2 beautiful grandchildren, and I planned on spending more time with them. They are currently in Minneapolis, but we're trying to lure them back this way. So there'll be a lot more opportunities to do that. My husband is actually a master's swimmer. So I have 3 children, really, girls and my husband. But I go to his meets and cheer him on.
Oh, I love that.
I used to be a swimmer as well. I'm actually considering going back to doing that, because I will tell you, when you go to these master's swim meets and you see 95-year-old people, women and men, doing the 100 fly, you think, you know what? I can do this.
Yeah, it's really inspiring. And it's one of the few sports that doesn't like wreck your joints as you get older. So
that's exactly right.
Yeah, that's awesome. I want to see a picture of you at poolside for sure. With your little cheerleading outfit on for Todd.
Yes, of course.
Well, Allison, this has been This has been awesome. I know that this isn't the end for you here at the Cleveland Clinic or with the many relationships you've made with folks here, but I just want to wish you all the best.
Thank you.
Really thank you for everything you've given back to all the people you've touched over these many, many decades of service to our organization.
It's been a true gift to me, and well done on your very first interview.
Oh, thank you. Thanks. I appreciate it.
Thank you for listening today. Join us again as we draw inspirations and insights from women doctors past, present, and future. You can follow us on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram at WPSA1. That's at WPSA and the number one. This podcast is supported by Cleveland Clinic's Women's Professional Staff Association as part of the Cleveland Clinic Centennial Celebration.